Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast, the podcast for serious lacrosse players and their supporters to help further their development and navigate their way throughout their lacrosse careers. And now, here are your hosts, New England Lacrosse Journal's Kyle Devitt and Jack Piatelli.
Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Devitt, and alongside me, Mr. Jack Piatelli. Jack, I almost forgot my name.
That's hard to do, huh? Because you talk to yourself every day in front of the mirror.
It's
how did the alumni game go, by the way?
Hey, one really
you guys
goal and an assist, oldest guy there by about 10 years. It's pretty dope.
Wow, and Clark lost again, huh?
I'm actually the alumni. Well,
yeah, I'm saying
the current Clark team did lose to the alumni. Yes, it was 12-10. It was a thrilling game.
I'm sure it was. Oh, I wish I was there to see it.
I bet you would have.
Especially your goal and assist. The fans must have been up and out of the seats, you know, going crazy when you scored.
All seven of them. They were really into it.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, let's welcome our guest, Pilo Whip Snakes Faceoff Man, Joe Nardella.
Great to have you. Yeah, I'm really excited to be here with you guys today. Obviously, I'm a fan of the journal and the podcast, so I'm excited to kind of contribute today and let you guys know a little bit behind the scenes of my story.
See, he's a fan. We don't get a lot of those. Mostly just coaches that are like, hey,
Kyle, speak for yourself, okay, please?
That's right. I forgot. Everyone loves Jack.
Talking about the New England Lacrosse Journal, not about you.
All right?
We got to get that straight with our listeners.
Hey, I do a lot of the content. Anyway.
Back to Joe.
So, I guess the best place to start is probably Rutgers. What led you to choose the Scarlet Knights?
So, a lot of people don't know this, but both my parents actually went to Rutgers, and one of my first like great lacrosse memories was going to the Final Four at Rutgers when they played Princeton, and I think that was something that stuck with me for a really, really long time, watching the Powell brothers like that. That's what allowed me to fall in love with the game, was going to the Carrier Dome, and that was one of my fondest like travel experiences as a family, was going to those games, and with my dad being like a complete crazed Rutgers fan in all sports, we used to go to the Rutgers-Syracuse football games every year almost, whether it was at Rutgers or at Syracuse, so I was familiar with the campus. That was one of the schools. Coach Dagneto was there. He was the first one to reach out to me in recruiting, and he actually ended up being the last one to reach out to me in recruiting. They had somebody fall out of their class. I had not been committed yet, and he offered me that final spot, and my father actually wanted me to go to West Point, and without telling him, I committed to Rutgers.
Which is ironic, because now Staggs is your pro coach.
Yeah, very ironic, right? It almost came full circle, and him and I have had a great relationship every step of the way.
I know that my encounters with Staggs are very stilted, I'll say. He's not one for fun stories or anecdotes. He's just straight business.
You know what you're going to get with him. That's what I really respect, you know?
Yeah, he's one of the best, and he was a pro coach long after he coach at Rutgers, and kind of after he brought you in, just has kind of built amazing teams.
Joe, I know your dad wanted you to go to Army, but he must have been excited that you decided to go to Rutgers, having your mom and dad and, you know, being a big fan of Rutgers.
He actually did end up being pretty excited about it. I think he was, you know, one of the lead fathers at the tailgates. He was one of the biggest fans, and he was at almost every game, so I think it ended up working out really, really well for our family.
I love your story. You know, you played high school lacrosse, obviously. You weren't a really high recruit, not even, I don't think you were in the top 100 back in the day, and you've become a household name in the professional PLL, NLL. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what motivated you to get to where you are today and how you know, it all played out.
You know, I really grew up loving the sport of hockey. That was my number one sport, and a lot of my friends did have serious interest recruiting-wise in lacrosse, and I was kind of one of the later kids on my high school team and on my club team to get that look from Rutgers. A lot of schools, you know, that are a little bit bigger, more well-known programs than Rutgers was at the time, like Syracuse and Cornell, actually passed on me after having me, you know, do overnight visits at their schools and such. And there was only a handful of schools that really wanted me. And I felt fortunate that Rutgers gave me an opportunity, but I was recruited as more of just a do-it-all kind of utility midfielder. I never really had formal face-off training or experience. Obviously, face-offs were a little bit different back then at the high school level, especially coming from upstate New York. But when I got to college, I've quickly figured out it was a whole different ball game, and that guys were specialists. Guys were really skilled at that position. Guys trained exclusively at that position. And a couple of Rutgers alums, Aaron Cardilla and Chris Mattis, both would come back to practice and help us out a lot in the fall of my freshman year. And I was probably, you know, fourth or fifth on the depth chart going into the spring or the end of fall ball. And me and one of my teammates, Blake Burkhart, actually, I went out to California with him, and we trained for like 3 weeks straight. We watched like game after game every single night. We would just stay out in the sun, take face-off after face-off, coaching kids, taking live reps, banging heads. And I think that was really like the first time I committed to being a good face-off guy. And going into the season, I was third string. The starter, maybe a week before our first game, decided to step away from the program. And then my first game, I played defensive midfield against Duke. I maybe got, like, you know, four or five runs. I was guarding guys that were a foot taller than me. And going into our third game against Wagner, the starter lost his scouting report, and that was my opportunity, and I did pretty well, and I kind of held on to that starting position the whole rest of my freshman year. I finished a little bit above 50%, mostly being a counter guy and just, you know, having that upstate New York knack for ground balls. And at the end of the season, Coach Breck said to me in our exit meeting, he's like, if this is something you really want to be good at, I think you have a ton of potential to be super successful at this position, but I need you to really commit to being as strong as possible, you know, staying in the gym all summer and training as hard as you can. And I did exactly that, and I came back and made a huge jump my sophomore year, and kind of that was my platform to take off.
Now, did you know going into Rutgers that you would be facing off, or is that something you decided to do when you got to the school?
You know, I really had no idea what Coach Brecht had in store for me. He had taken the job. You know, I remember Coach Stagnita sending out an email that he resigned maybe my last week of my senior year of high school, and then Coach Brecht was hired shortly after, and I really had no idea where I would fall. I just knew I would do anything I could to try to make an impact on the team and do whatever was asked of me. And I think, you know, being somebody who scored maybe 70 points as a midfielder in my senior year of high school and not playing much defense, like, I went straight into that defensive midfield role feeling like that was the only way I really could contribute as a freshman. In faceoffs, I was extremely far behind a few of the other guys in terms of my experience and my knowledge and IQ at it. And I think it just happened to so like work out that that's where the team needed me the most. And I was able to get some playing time there.
Great point, because so many players go into, you know, a program, whether it's Rutgers or Syracuse, as an attackman or a midi or a defense, and they think that that's the only position they can play and they're best suited to play that position. They haven't tried the other positions. And to your case, right, you go to Rutgers, now you're playing defense, you're a 70-point scorer in high school, and you become one of the best face-off guys in the country. And it's a perfect example of you got to be willing and able to do anything to get on the field, and you really don't know until you try.
That's 100% right. And like, I don't even think they planned on me playing throughout the fall of my freshman year. I remember, you know, they were trying to change the culture. We had a lot of kids on the team who weren't great at that time, like probably, you know, wouldn't play on some of the teams we were playing against. And I was like, I got to figure out a way to get on the field. And then I would stay after practice, go early to practice. I'd be the last one digging balls out of the snow. I was sprinting when we were doing the ball hunts. Every little thing I could try to do, like, I was doing it. And, you know, those are the things, like, the coaches noticed. I don't even know if they noticed my play on the field before they probably noticed me digging balls out of the snow.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, the famous story of if some – or the adage that if the team's running – or anyone on the team's running, you're running with that guy, right?
And that's right.
I think that's kind of the next man up mentality that, you know, I wish was more prevalent, right? In kind of the softer side of lacrosse, let's put it that way. And I know that that's not where you're kind of stationed, right? Like, you're a hard nose, you're a hard work guy. Tell me how to build a face-off guy from zero.
If you look at all the top guys in college, I think there's always one similarity, and it's that they're strong, right? I think being successful at that position starts and really ends with being an absolute beast in the weight room, being able to do more than other guys, being able to outwork other guys. I think it also comes down to watching a ton of film and understanding exactly what's going on, because you see it all the time. And this is something like I pride myself on, is like, I don't really get killed in very many games. Obviously, if you go back and look at my stats throughout my career, you could probably find, you know, 4 or 5 games where I've gone like 30 or 40%, but there's not many more than that. And I think it's because I'm able to make in-game adjustments. And I think a lot of kids get in their own heads, they get frustrated and they don't like see it as the big picture of the game, right? And I'm lucky I've had coaches like Coach Brecht and Coach Stagnita that have trusted me and allowed me to figure it out when I may not have been doing as well early on in the game. But I think a lot of kids have to have a level head. You have to be a beast in the weight room. You got to be able to pick up tough ground balls, and you got to be able to pass and catch, because the face-off position is predicated around getting your team possession. And if you can't, like, you know, fight off their best, most athletic pull to get your attackman the ball, like, you're not an expert at getting possession.
What is the best crossover sport for a face-off athlete?
You know, a lot of people say wrestling. I'm going to go the other way and say hockey, just because I think, like, playing in the indoor game, I've seen so many Canadians who've played hockey they're just, I think, the best loose ball guys. And you see it a lot in the indoor game, is these guys pick up crazy tough ground balls with one hand, two hand, getting crushed by 3 or 4 guys. I think wrestling's a great crossover sport for like the mental side and the one-on-one aspect of facing off, but I would almost argue that hockey is a little bit better for like the fluidity and the savviness on the, like, of picking up the ball and holding possession and making plays.
You talked about strength getting in the weight room. Is there any part of your body the strength is more important? Is it your arms or your legs facing off?
Yeah, you know, I train at a great place now called Compete Strength and Conditioning in Norwood, Mass. And we've done a ton of stuff predicated around grip, forearm strength, core stabilization, balance under pressure, right? And a lot of the conditioning they'll have me do will involve picking up ground balls at the end of the running, which I think is huge and super important and something that's been overlooked. And I know at Rutgers we did a ton of, like, you know, the football type lifts. Obviously it was a little different between 2012 and 2015 in terms of how athletes were trained for lacrosse, but I do think a lot of those, like, you know, strength building exercises really helped me. And I think, you know, core is the number one thing, and one thing that's kind of stuck with me throughout my entire career is, like, even from when I was like 10 years old, my dad had my brother and I doing push-ups and pull-ups every single day as like our accountability checks. And I think those two things helped me develop both upper body and core strength that's really helped me on ground balls and just being in those grind out battles of the face-off.
You've kind of lived through, just, you're 29, you've lived through every face-off era now.
Pretty much, yeah.
Because it kind of started in the early 2000s that there were specialists, Paul Canabine, and then, you know, coming up through the MLL and guys becoming specialists there, I think is actually, people talk about things leading up to pro. I actually think pro very much influenced college in terms of face-off play and LSMs once LSMs were added to the MLL. What is your kind of perspective on the different eras of the face-off position and, like, where, you know, where do you think you fit in there?
I think that's a great question. You know, my first knowledge of the guys being specialists were the Alex Smiths of the world, who were the first guys doing moto grip, pinching and popping, standing up. And then you remember guys like Matt Schomburg, who introduced the knee down moto grip, and you see a ton of guys picked up on that. And that's kind of where the transition for me started in my college career, was going from standing up in moto grip to knee down in moto grip. And I had a little struggle with it my junior year. I tried to switch mid-season, and I remember getting my butt whooped in our last game of the season by Tyler Narr. And I was like, oh my God, like, I'm so not there yet at this. And then my senior year, I felt a lot more comfortable with it. And then obviously not much has changed in the pros in terms of the rules. Obviously the PLL has spaced the ball out a little more, so it starts towards the top of the stick. And the NLL, you kind of start further back, but it's closer to the throat. I think I try to fall somewhere in the middle of like where the college game is with being able to face off stand up. And because of my coaching with the face off factor, I almost take more stand up face offs now than I do knee down. So that's allowed me to kind of evolve and do that. And I mean, if you look at the playoff stretch that we had last year, obviously we came up a little short, but my last three or four games, I was facing off almost exclusively standing up. And that was something that allowed me to throw a wrinkle at my opponents when I maybe wasn't having my best games, and I was able to bounce back. So I like to think of myself as almost like a chameleon in the sense that I could really try to master all of those rule sets and adaptations that have come our way. And I think anyone who wants to be successful at that position kind of has to embrace that same mentality.
Well, that same mentality you had going into Rutgers and being willing to play any position, and now you've learned to face off and have be able to adjust to your competition. What advantages are there by standing up versus kneeling down? What are the advantages of both and disadvantages for you and maybe some of the listeners?
I'll take that one and kind of say for standing up, I think it's created exactly what it was anticipated to in terms of the college game. There's been more transition, more of the face-offs are quicker. There's some cleaner wins. There's some, you know, more chaotic ground balls. So I think those have all been really good things. And I think the advantages of standing up in, you know, a league like the PLL where you could do either is getting the ball out quick, being able to push transition quick, getting the ball, you know, to ground balls rather than clamps and clean pinch and pops to yourself. So that's something that I've liked about it, and I think I've been able to make it hard on my opponents by using it. And I think the obvious advantages of knee down are the leverage and your ability to get close to the ball. So you really do have to be very, very well versed in knee down in the PLL because, you know, a dominant knee down clamper in theory is closer to the ball than someone standing up. So they should be able to have a little bit more power, a little bit more force, and a little bit more control once they win that clamp. And you obviously see some guys dominate in those aspects of the game where they get the clamp and they're almost unbeatable in terms of countering them.
So that's the leads into the easiest question of anyone that isn't a quote-unquote face-off guy to ask: how do you beat a good clamp?
I think with strategy, with persistence, and with trying to keep them guessing. That's why I think it's really important to be versed in both standing up and knee down. But you know, if you go back and watch tapes of some of my games, I've gone against guys who are better than me at clamping throughout my career. And with the ability to kind of mix up my moves and throw wrinkles at them, I've been able to level the playing field a little bit and make it a little bit more even. And as I've gotten better at clamping, I think, you know, my game's just elevated significantly.
Would you classify yourself as a counter guy?
Yes and no. I think I've gotten better at my first move as I've gotten to be more veteran in my career. But I would say I'm probably, you know, aside from Jake Withers in the PLL, probably second most effective with my counters. And we could obviously look at some of the stats. I know they do a pretty good job with, like, their stats of when you lose the clamp, who gets the ball back. So I'd be interested to see if that checks out fact-wise. But, yeah, I would say I'm definitely more of like a clamp slash counter guy than just a counter guy, but yeah.
Right. So let's talk about that a little bit. Cause I think what people don't realize is that in college, they really only call the face-off win if you get the ground ball.
That's right.
Right. But with face-off guys and other people that are kind of looking at advanced metrics and things like that, it's who wins the ball out, not who picks it up. And then it's two different stats, really. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think college should kind of move to that to get a little bit more understanding of the position, or is it just too much to ask?
No, I do think it's a great point for coaches and players to kind of understand where their wins or their losses are coming from. But, like, in terms of what you're saying, I completely agree. Like, whoever gets the ball wins the face-off. If a kid comes off the field and is like, oh, I won the clamp, it's like, doesn't matter if you win the clamp. It's whoever gets the ball, whoever gets their team possession. So I'm totally in that camp of, like, I agree it should be one stat, but I think for a player or a coach kind of analyzing their success and how they could be better, it's extremely important to understand those metrics as well.
New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal will return after this message.
This fall, Quincy College in Quincy, Massachusetts drops the puck on its first ever hockey season in the City of Presidents, just 10 minutes from Boston. The Granite, as they're known, will play in the CHF Collegiate Hockey Federation against Babson, Mass Maritime, Nichols, Sacred Heart, and D3 programs at UNH and Farmingdale State in New York. The Quincy College Granite will be well coached. Kyle Robertson has been coaching regional junior teams for 20 years, and over 100 of his players have gone on to NCAA programs. Kyle's assistant is Matt Gibbons, who's been coaching at North Quincy High for 12 years and won 3 titles there. 3 years ago, he was the MIAA Coach of the Year. And as far as the educational part, Quincy College has a lot to offer. 37 different 2-year degrees, and it's super affordable. There's even a new 4-year business management degree that costs much less than other 4-year schools. Want to make some history in a first-year hockey program? Now's your chance. Get more info at quincycollege.edu/hockey.
Are you serious about playing your sport in college? Do you need a flexible education that allows you to maintain your practice and competition schedules while also preparing you to succeed at the next level? You should check out the University of Nebraska High School. UNHS is accredited and offers more than 100 online courses, including NCAA-approved courses to protect your academic eligibility. Students could earn a UNHS diploma or take a single course for transfer credit. Courses are college prep, self-paced, and available 24/7, 365. Enroll anytime and take up to a year to complete a course. Visit highschool.nebraska.edu today.
Looking to keep up with all the latest news and information on New England lacrosse? New England Lacrosse Journal and LaxJournal.com are the premier resources for information and inspiration on the New England lacrosse scene. Have every issue of New England Lacrosse Journal, the magazine, delivered to your home or office. And don't forget to stay in the game every day with a digital subscription to LaxJournal.com to receive daily digital lacrosse coverage on club lacrosse, college commits, prep and high school, Division I, II, and III colleges, showcases, rankings, and much more. Get in the game and behind the scenes now by logging on to LaxJournal.com. Just click on the subscribe button and start the subscription that is right for you today. New England Lacrosse Journal is a Siemens Media publication. Siemens Media. Inspiring. Informative. Insightful.
What's the first set of exercises that you teach when you're kind of indoctrinating a new face-off guy?
This is a good question to ask because it's not even anything physical. It's more so mental and talking about breathing and being able to focus. I think if you could get to the ball first, you have such an advantage on your opponent. And like if the three of us lined up and punched into thin air, like is our punch speed really going to be that different from each other? Probably not. But whoever focuses and can anticipate the best is probably going to be a little bit quicker. So we talk about breathing exercises. I talk with all my students about meditation and the benefits that can have on you. In terms of like having a short memory, even when you don't get to the ball first. And really, like we do a couple of focus drills, like as simple as dropping a ball down over your head and like working on that, the breathing pattern of like when the ref says down, you're taking your breath in, or some people like holding their breath, right? But for me, when the ref says down, I'm taking a deep breath in and I'm trying to slowly exhale right before he says the word set. So almost like, you know, when you're bench pressing, you're breathing out as you're getting that punch, or when you're accelerating off the line in a 40-yard dash, you're breathing out as you're taking that first most explosive step.
Well, I think my punch is faster than Jack's.
Maybe.
We'll see.
Well, Jack's a little older than you. You got to give him some slack.
Yeah, no, I could take one of your punches, but you wouldn't be able to take one of mine, that's for sure. That goes without saying.
I walked into that. I deserve that.
It's like a mosquito. You have to fly swatter out.
Wow.
Joe, what was the transition like for you going from outdoor PLL to indoor? I know you're a big fan of the NLL for a number of different reasons. Explain.
You know, the transition's very different for me because in a PLL game, if you, like, record the time on the field, it's probably, you know, no more than 5 minutes total of the course of that 48-minute game. And then if you look at indoor, you know, I'm on the field almost every other shift on the defensive end. I'm a little bit more involved, and I think that just helps my overall skill set development. You know, our coaches are great, and they've taught me how to kind of play within the box system of our team defense, which is something, you know, being an American who didn't grow up playing box, unlike all these Canadian kids who've played their entire life, like, I was significantly behind that during my first year. And I remember there were games in that first season where I'd get in, like, Jack, you watched a lot of the games, you could probably attest to this, like, I would be out there and maybe the cause of one or two goals, and they would sit me down on the defensive end for a couple shifts. And, like, that was something that really motivated me to be better. And, like, I always took my medicine and knew, like, if I just stuck with it and kept learning, kept watching film, kept asking questions, that I'd get better at. But I think, you know, what's really motivated me and kind of driven me in the box game is, like, just being that well-rounded, all-around player that can – not only help my team on the defensive end, but cause turnovers, pick up tough loose balls, be a great communicator, and then add that face-off element as like an extra bonus, you know? And I think if I can be as good of a defender as the 10 other guys that kind of dress out that back door and face off, like, I'm insanely valuable to the team. And that's something that I, like, have striven to be, you know, over the course of the past 6 months in the indoor game. And it's definitely a grind. You know, we had 5 weekends of training camp leading up to 18 games in one playoff game. So I think I played a lot of lacrosse over the past 6 months, and I feel pretty ready for the PLL season coming up.
Has the NLL made you a better face-off player? It's made you a better overall player, but a better face-off player?
1,000%. We were talking about this before the show, and, you know, the refs let a little bit more go, so it makes you get better with your exits and really plan on where you're going to get out to the ball. The space is obviously much tighter, and the players don't have to wait within the restraining boxes. They can come right in and come after you. So what it's forced me to do is get much better at using my teammates to pop the ball out to strategic places. So I think that's something, like, I'm excited to utilize in the outdoor game this season.
And you got to keep your head up a little bit more in the indoor game, too, off the face-off?
Absolutely. And, like, obviously, there's a toughness aspect of the indoor game, too. Like, guys take shots at you. Obviously, being a face-off guy, all these Canadian kids are always talking trash to me, calling me a fogo, trying to come after me, trying to get in my head. And, like, even guys who I played with, like Brody Merrill, like, the entire game, he's jawing at me during our game.
Yeah, which I kind of want to say is ironic, because I know that, you know, you talk a little bit. You talk a little bit when people talk to you, I think, is fair enough. You're also well-known, at least in media circles, because that's where I kind of know you the best from your days is in the MLL and PLL. The kind of no-one-believes-in-me guy, I'd like to say, for the record, I kind of am on the good side of that, because I don't think I ever really, like, besmirched you in anything I wrote, which is not what I can say for a lot of pro guys. But I always liked that you could do more after the draw. And I think now that I, you know, realize that, you know, you grew up and then became a face-off guy instead of a face-off guy and you became something else, it's just so helpful in understanding that mentality, right? And you're going into your fourth PLL season now. You've been, I think, if you measure every metric of defense, offense, goals, assists, and draws, I don't think anyone's really close to your production after the whistle. And you have a background in that. Is that something you take a lot of pride in going into, you know, year four in the PLL?
Absolutely. That's what I predicate my game on. I think that's where Coach Stagnita sees a ton of value in my game. And I think, you know, that's where my teammates really appreciate what I can do on the field. I may not win, you know, the highest percentage of faceoffs in the league, but I think there's a lot of other things that go into being a great faceoff guy. And when I was a college coach, we would always talk about, like, you know, the best offenses in college score a little bit above, like, a 33% clip, right? So really, like, every one possession you get at the faceoff dot is what? A third of a goal. But if you can put in a goal or a point a game, right, that should make up for three faceoffs. So I think I try to look at the game a little more analytically in that sense and not hang myself up on, like, oh, I got to be over 50% today. It's like, no, I got to steal a few faceoffs back from my opponent today. I got to make a couple plays in transition. I got to make sure they don't score any goals off draws, and I got to get more ground balls than the other guy. And I think if I can do a couple of those things, like, our team's going to be in a great spot no matter what the final stats say at the draw.
And let's talk about, you know, you're coaching at Harvard you were there for 4 years.
Yes.
We've seen the explosion of the Ivy League this year in 2022, but when you were there, it was kind of, you know, a one bid league to the NCAA tournament. What has changed in your estimation from when you coached to now?
I think the Ivy League is just getting, you know, the same level of recruits as the Big Ten and the ACC. I think they, all those coaches have done a great job of kind of resurging and revamping up the recruiting. I think lacrosse is shifting towards, you know, most of the kids knowing they got to be great students if they want to go to great schools. So I think a lot of kids have been more available for those Ivy League schools to get in this next generation of high aspiring academic students. And I think it's great for our sport that these schools are, you know, competing with some of the top, you know, perennial powers in our sport.
So when you were at Harvard, I assume you were in charge of recruiting face-off guys, right? What did you look for, and how did that influence what you teach now as to guys that are getting recruited?
You know, it was interesting because I didn't necessarily recruit any of the kids that I got to coach. So that was like a very interesting factor. We had kids who were great athletes and great face-off guys, but we also played a really tough schedule. So I think what we looked for and what I tried to instill in those guys was exactly what I just told you. Like, we would keep our stats based on how many face-offs we were able to steal back when we lost the clamp versus how many we gave away when we won the clamp. And I told those guys, I don't want you to like beat yourself up about not winning the ball every single game, but we got to find a way to create possessions and manufacture possessions, and that could hopefully keep us in games. And we had some years that were better than others, some days that we struggled more than others. But I think, like, you know, over the course of those couple of years, we looked for guys who were athletic, who could make the lives of their opponents significantly more difficult. And if you look at some of the guys that I coached that, you know, are wrapping up their senior year and just had the most successful year in Harvard's history, Steve Cucurillo and Kyle Massimilian, I think they arguably both had maybe their best year of their career this year with the switch to stand up because of a lot of the things we did early on in their career. And then a lot of credit goes to Will Corrigan, who kind of, you know, talks with me. We chatted about ways to make these guys continue to get better. And I think they both really adopted that, like, I don't got to win the ball initially, but we're going to get it back and make it a 3-on-3. And with great wing play, those guys did an awesome job this year.
And watching a lot of the Ivy League games over the last few years, I've noticed a great difference in the face-offs. To your point, you see a lot of players at the face-off circle win the face-off and then they lose possession for a number of different reasons. And I want to go back to your point is, if you want to be a face-off guy, you've really got to develop your athleticism. You got to be, you know, quicker, faster, but the stick skills, you've got to develop your stick skills to, because when you have possession of the ball, these athletes are so big, strong, you know, the LSMs, you know, they're right on you with the long poles, being able to create so many turnovers. But the face-off guys that are successful that I watch, and I think you'll agree, aren't necessarily the guys who are winning the draw. They're the guys who are might be picking up the ground ball and able to look upfield and make the right pass and make the right play. And, you know, when they have a fast break, they're not always taking a shot. They're hitting the top guy. They really have a good understanding of the game, you know, and what their role is and how important that possession is.
Yeah, and I mean, the three of us probably watch a ton of college lacrosse collectively. Who do you guys think the two best in Division I are? Because I have two guys in mind, like, hands down, that I think have been the best this season.
I mean, for me, it's Sis and Mike Sisselberger, and I love Tommy Burke, even though what happened, but, and Weirman's up there too.
My favorite was T.D. Lowen.
I meant this year.
No, this year. He's talking this year.
I know he is. Who do you like?
I mean, I think, you know, two guys that have made a huge impact both offensively for their teams are Weirman and Zach Cole. And I think if you watch their game, like, Maryland probably had 3 or 4 face-off transition goals this past weekend against mm-hmm. Virginia. And, you know, he's not going against any sludge. He's going against an all-ACC guy in Petey LaSalle. Like, I think Weirman and Zach Cole both had the ability to, like, score. And I think, you know, Sis is another guy. He does a great job with the ball and his stick as well. I think that part of his game gets overlooked because he's such a dominant clamper. But, like, those three guys, man, like, that's where the face-off position is trending. The kids who are big, strong, athletic, can handle the ball, can put passes on a rope to their teammates in transition, do work off the ground, counter their opponents. Like, those guys are, you know, the mold and the carbon copy of what every coach is going to look for over the next couple of years. So when you talk about, like, you know, what I looked for as a coach or what these guys look for in recruiting, I think you look at three guys like that, that's where the position's trending. And if you can't do all those things, you're not probably going to be a high-level Division I recruit. You're not going to have pro potential. And I think it's super important to watch some of the top guys in our college game because the game is getting so much more advanced at that level.
Do you think that the stand-up rule has recreated more fast breaks? That's what I see. I'm not a face-off guy. I don't know a lot about face-offs, but we are seeing more transition goals, more fast break goals, because when you had the pinch and the pop, you didn't really the fast break game was not a big part of the game, and that's what's so much fun about watching lacrosse is the 5-on-4s and the 4-on-3s, the way the ball moves around and, you know, finds the goal.
Absolutely. It takes, you know, a second or a little more than a second less than it does to pop it out and scoop the ball up from your feet than it does on your knee. So it gives the wing guys less time to get in, and, you know, and I just think it creates more transition overall, like we talked about earlier in the show.
Just tons of, I think also the big switch to stand up is it eliminated the a little bit of the rock fighting.
100%, right? Like, there's way less of that. You know, you'll see someone will post on Twitter, oh, the 45-second tie-up. It's like, well, there's only a couple of them this season versus, yeah, you know, one or two every single game.
I think it's a huge difference. And I want to kind of talk to you about that. Why do they keep changing the rules? Why do you think they keep changing it? Is just because, and this is my theory, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth. This is me talking. I think it's just old coaches not recruiting face-off guys well enough and getting their butts kicked and being like, we got to take this out. I can't control this.
I think that's definitely part of it, right? And I've sat, and I'm sure you guys have as well, some of those rules committee meetings at the annual convention, and I think that's definitely part of it. I think another part of it is they just get frustrated with not having the ball, right?
Yeah.
And it's tough to recruit those types of kids. If you look at, you know, Luke Weirman and Zach Colin, obviously Sis is an anomaly because he was highly recruited. Those other two guys were not, right? So it's like not like you're going to hit on getting a big recruit.
Yeah, it's hard to recruit face-off guys.
100%.
And you'd think that would be a premium, right, is having like someone that's a face-off guy come in and almost like evaluate what you have and what you can work with. And I know that's like kind of part of what you do. You help train them up. But why do you think that's not better rephrase of this question? When do you think there becomes a dedicated face-off coach for like every top 20 D1 team?
You know, a lot of guys have always tried to have one on staff. Like if you look at Maryland, a lot of times their volunteer role has been a face-off guy. Rutgers, their volunteer role this year is a face-off guy. Like a lot of those schools are really prioritizing that. And I know other schools may prioritize goalie. Mm-hmm. But if you look at some of the coaches that are either the third or the fourth assistant on those teams, like they're having them work with the face-off guys. And like I mentioned, Harvard has Will Corrigan. Like he's been an absolute student of the face-off position to try to get his guys to the point where they can help the team out. Right, so I think you're going to continue to see coaches try to evolve and learn how to face off, and you know, that's, for me, it's very fortunate because I'll always probably have a job as long as the face offs in our game.
Do you get frustrated at all getting lumped in with goalies? Because it's a totally different position, but like you're both quote unquote specialists, and everyone, you know, fights for those All American stats, and there's only, you know, whereas with face-off guys, there's more than one usually playing a game.
Yeah.
With a goalie, there's only one. Is that strange for you? Like, do you have a relationship with that?
Yeah, I don't mind getting lumped in with the goalies. You know, one of my best friends on the Whip Snakes is Kyle Burnlore. I think it's very unique because a lot of the similarities between face-offs and goalies lies within the mental part of the game, which I think is so overlooked by people from the outside, right? You're almost playing against yourself as well as the other people on the field. So I think, you know, face-off guys and goalies having the perspective to kind of understand each other's positions only helps you get better at yours. And I think, you know, I've learned a lot from Kyle about next play mentality, about shaking off bad games, about like really being in your zone and what that feels like. And I think anyone who can kind of get with an elite goalie, like you'll learn so much with just how they carry themselves and like their routines, their cycles of how they like act and train. And I've been lucky, like Nick Morocco lives up here in Boston and we've been shooting once or twice a week for the past few weeks. And like he does different things differently than Kyle when we warm up and when we start. And like I worked with the goalies a little bit at Harvard and like love to appreciate those guys. So I think that's only made me like a more knowledgeable lacrosse player, athlete, and like really allowed me to think about the mental game with a different perspective.
Do you think the face-off position is is the most difficult position to transition from high school to college?
I think every position is difficult to transition from high school to college, honestly. Like, I wouldn't, you know, say face-offs is harder than any other position because I think the jump is so different from every like high school league to every team, division one, two or three, like it's going to be tough no matter what, and no matter what kind of program you're adopting into. But I do think like the face-off guys from a physical standpoint, it's very difficult to come in and be a stud right away as a freshman, because like we talked about earlier, strength plays such a role, right? And maturity and your mental like fortitude plays such a role that you see those guys often develop those things at a later time.
How about college to pro though? How much of a switch is that?
You know, I think with the rules, it's definitely a switch. I think that's going to make it, you know, maybe a little bit tougher than other positions. I think goalies are in the same boat because they're seeing a way more elite level.
That's the biggest one.
Yeah, I agree. You're seeing just an elite level of shooter across the board. But I do think that makes the jump a little bit more difficult as the rule changes. And, like, you know, you're not getting any easy games. You're going against grown men every single week. But I do think, you know, even at the other positions, like, any attackman is now dodging the number one kid from every single team they played on in college, you know?
Yeah.
Now, you talked about you had 4 weeks of training camp with the Albany team, 18-game season, one playoff game. How do you keep your body in, you know, that type of shape and get yourself ready mentally, physically to jump right into the PLL?
You know, I do a variety of different things on the treatment front. Obviously, like, I train at Compete, and they do a great job of, you know, not crushing me. Like, we do a lot more of regenerative stuff, lower impact stuff, a lot of movement, a lot of speed work. And then I actually see three different physical therapists throughout the course of the week. I got my girl Danielle. She's awesome. At Boston Sports up in Arlington, I go down to Marathon to see Alex McKinney down in Dedham. And then I often go to TB12, like, every other week to see Morgan, who was he was our trainer for the Whip Snakes and the Bubbles. So like, I try to mix it up and do a little bit different treatments with each of those guys. Morgan's more of like a deep tissue at TB12. Danielle, we do a little bit more needling based stuff. And I think all of those things kind of coupled together have helped me just stay in a rhythm and, you know, not feel like I'm getting the crap beat out of me every single week. And like, at 29 years old, my training is more focused on feeling good than getting stronger.
What's the best treatment to recover from like a little niggle that you suffer in a game, like a hard check or just like a little pulled muscle?
I think it's like, you know, it's tough to say. I've done so many different things. Like, I've been to Kairos over the years. I've, you know, done the deep tissue at TB12. I think all of them play like a pivotal role in me just feeling better. I do love dry needling though. Like, obviously I don't like needles, and like Danielle will tell you, I'm kind of like soft when she gets me in a good spot. But I think that's something that gives me great release. That's something that, you know, when I was recovering from my ACL, I started doing that, and like, I would feel, you know, like there'd be days where I feel like I could jog and cut again before I was even cleared. And I was like, this is pretty legit.
Yeah. And I've had a piriformis, and I got needled in the piriformis, and I'm fine. Just once. It's such a, like, you brought it up and I was like, ooh,
yeah,
I want to talk about that, because it is like, I guess it's scary, 'cause like, you see the needle or whatever, but, and it's a little acupuncture-y. That's kind of the roots of it. But the dry needling is, pretty great. Anytime my mom's a personal trainer, and anytime I got hurt or like got hurt training or whatever, she's like, do you want me to needle it? And I'm like, that is not the solution to everything, and it actually might be.
And I honestly think it's great, and acupuncture is, you know, rooted in thousands of years of use.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about your diet. Does it change that much throughout the year, and how important is your diet along with the conditioning to keep yourself playing at such a high level?
You know, I think it's arguably, aside from sleep and like taking care of your body, like those are the top three, really, is your nutrition, your sleep, and your recovery. But I think, you know, for me, I try to cook almost every single meal. Obviously, these last two weekends of off season, so to speak, I had wedding stuff going on, and like, I noticeably feel the difference after a weekend when I don't eat all healthy stuff. So, you know, for any young athletes out there listening, the sooner you can incorporate learning how to cook, how to just eat healthy, like, your body will feel so much better, your performance will be better, you know, your mindset will be better, and you'll feel more confident in your game. And like, I think that's one thing, you know, in that's really helped me over the, you know, from like 23 to 29, like elevate my game, was taking nutrition more seriously.
And you talk about eating healthy. Exactly what do you eat? What do you consider healthy foods for you and to perform at a high level?
I keep it pretty simple. Like, I, you know, eat a ton of fruits, vegetables, and protein. Like, I do go pretty hard on the carbs when we're playing or where I'm training a lot, and like try to keep it to like complex carbs like quinoa, brown rice, you know, sweet potatoes, stuff like that. But really for me, it's just a ton of protein, a ton of veggies, and then like my snacks, I'll try to make like fruit or like really, you know, gluten-free like chips, stuff like that.
So you got to be very disciplined for you to be able to play at the level you're playing at. You're training, you're recovering, you're eating. You need to have a tremendous discipline in order to keep all the different things in order.
Yeah, and I really think at this point it comes with the territory. Like, I doubt you'll see a lot of, like, 25 to 35-year-old professional lacrosse players who don't eat well anymore. I think our game is phasing into, like, every little thing matters that you do.
Like, when we had Kyle Harrison on, and he said right after he retired, Jack Neer sent a box of 6 donuts to his house. You know, it's kind of one of those things, right? Like, now you can eat real people food, kind of is what he was saying. But yeah, I think that's great. Do you subscribe to a specific like paleo or anything like that, gluten-free?
I don't know. I've actually experimented with, and I probably get them like, you know, twice a month, the Nutri-Meals, and they're just like pre-made, like, you know, 400 or 500 calorie meals that's either protein, veggie, and carbs. And I think those have made it easy when I'm like on the go or really busy with, like, you know, Face Off Factory or real estate, and I'm running around a lot. Like, that's been a great supplement to not having to cook when I have a ton of stuff going on in my daily life. So I'd recommend, like, anyone who's very busy in their professional life, that's like, that's a huge piece for me, is being able to have the convenience of healthy food also.
Right. And, you know, we haven't talked all that much PLL, so let's get right into it, because you're going into training camp this week as we're recording this. You're on the most successful PLL franchise that there is, the Whipsnakes. You've gotten to the championship game 3 years in a row. You've won two of them. The team in 2020 that played in the bubble in Utah might be the best pro team I've ever seen. When you were on that team playing in that high stress environment and still just whopping people, what was that experience like for you? Did you know in the moment that you were kind of part of something very great and historic in the moment?
You know, I really didn't think about it. We stayed pretty present. But, like, as you're talking about it, and as, you know, I've read some of the press or the stats from, you know, those 6 to 7 games that we had, like, it kind of gives me the chills, because, you know, I had people texting me, like, you guys are a juggernaut. And it's like, nobody in pro lacrosse has really been that in a long time, I think. So it was pretty special for us to run the slate. And, like, I don't overlook that in any way. I'm very, like, grateful for that experience. But obviously last year, like, we took a little bit of a step down, and I know, you know, we still made it back to the championship with a lot more struggle. But one thing that, you know, I think about was going into that bubble season, there was nothing else going on. So every single person on our team, I felt like committed to being the best versions of their self. And I think over the course of this offseason, that's something that I've focused on, that we've talked about, and a lot of our teammates are kind of taking stock in. It's like, we have to get back to just being the best version of each individual competitor and being the best teammates, and we might be able to return to that same form.
Well, you got picked apart by 2 expansions, so not really your fault. If you were actually just straight up that first team and second team those first 2 years, I mean, that's a wild assortment of talent. You had number one guys at every position. I mean, and you said in 2020, it was more than a juggernaut. Your average margin of victory, I think, was like 6.8 goals a game. Like, it's wild. I remember writing about it and just being like, I don't think people understand what this is. But I remember when you guys announced that you were going to play that season and you had all these COVID protocols, people started to get really excited. And then, like, there was some lightning delays and games got pushed back. And that actually was much cooler for people like me that have been doing pro lacrosse forever. And you're kind of like, oh, now we're in this very kind of exclusive club of people that love pro lacrosse watching this. We're all together. And social media really helped that. And the PLL social media really helped that as well.
I completely agree, and I think, you know, the PLL has done an amazing job on that front of getting more eyes on our game, and I think that bubble experience almost was like the liftoff. I felt like that was more more watched and more heightened than the previous season.
Okay, last question for me. What's the biggest difference between the MLL and the PLL?
I think just the way Mike and Paul run the league is on a completely different level than it was ever run before. I think they take it more seriously. They're absolute hustlers as entrepreneurs. And I think, you know, as somebody who started my own business and do a lot of entrepreneurial things myself, there's nothing more that I respect, you know, than those two grinding it out and putting everything on the line for the players and for the league and the game of lacrosse. So I would say just the way they handle themselves, the way they treat everybody, how professional it's been, and how much they're like really trying to push this thing forward, it shows in their everyday work, and I'm extremely appreciative of those guys for that.
I couldn't agree more. Pro lacrosse needs more eyeballs. It's going to be on ESPN this year, so make sure you catch a game, and if you don't have a team yet, you got to root for the Whips, right?
Yeah. Hopefully we'll win a bunch of games, and it'll be easy to cheer for us.
Go Whips, roll Whips. All right. Thanks again for listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. For Jack Piatelli and our amazing producer, Steve Safran, I'm Kyle Devitt. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, fellas.
Thanks for coming on, Joe.
You've been listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Also, listen to the podcast on the website, laxjournal.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at NELaxJournal, Instagram at New England Lacrosse Journal, Lax Journal on Facebook, and our email address, chasingthegoal@laxjournal.com. Join us again next time as we go chasing the goal. Chasing the Goal, a Siemens Media podcast.